The little brown fox jumped over the lazy dog.
The little brown fox jumped over the lazy dog.
The little brown fox jumped over the lazy dog.
Okay, I think that's enough. Seems like the mics are working.
Good.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Hi, Matt.
The internal medicine podcast that uses expert interviews.
Well, that's self-aggrandizing.
To bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. Actually, on this episode, there is no expert guest. This is actually our first roundtable show.
But we're on a square table, so it's okay.
Well, yeah, it's rectangular.
I failed kindergarten.
I'm Dr. Matthew Watto, here with my co-host, Dr. Stuart Brigham.
Hi, Matt.
And Dr. Paul Williams.
Matt, Stuart, lovely to be with you, as always.
Oh, hi, Paul.
And what are we going to do on this episode? So we have a vague idea.
I have no idea.
But before we get started, I did want to say that the views expressed on this show are those of the Curbsiders and do not represent the views of the places where we work.
Or used to.
Except for Cashlack Memorial Hospital, because that's a fictional place.
Cashlack.
So let's just say they're the views of Cashlack Memorial Hospital.
Way to go, Cashlack.
And so let's start. With a pick of the week.
All right.
Flawless segue.
Cue the sound effects. Okay. Who would like to give their pick of the week here?
I will not go first.
Okay. Paul, do you have anything you're excited about or that you think that you would like to tell our audience about?
He'd like to see the
inauguration. This is probably a bad forum to mention this, just because now I'll be somewhat accountable, but I've set a personal goal for myself to actually watch 365 movies in 365 days this year.
How successful have you been so far?
So, this is cutting into my movie time, so I probably should get going shortly, but I will say one that I watched as part of that is the movie Sing Street, which has nothing to do with any kind of medicine, but it's a nice escapist movie. It's called Sing Street. It's directed by this guy named John Carney, and it's set in the mid-1980s. And it's basically the story of this Irish kid who forms a band basically just to get the attention of a girl that he likes. And it's basically a movie for people who are, as old as me, so not you guys, I guess, who sort of, the 80s were formative years. And it's kind of charming because as the band starts to write their own music, you can actually see their influences. So initially they're, aping Duran Duran, and then eventually they progress through The Cure. And then they're copying Hall & Oates, and it's just all in the service of kind of to get the girl, but also in the service of music, and it's sort of music as a redemptive thing, which is not a new concept, but it's a movie I really, really enjoyed and would highly recommend, and it's easy to find on Netflix. So that would be my pick of the week, I think.
Paul, you're so eloquent.
I don't know how you're going to find time to watch one movie or 365 movies. So are you gonna like batch and watch like five movies on a Saturday so you don't have to watch one each weekday?
Yeah, that's kind of what it's shaken out to be. So the weekends are a little bit more fruitful in terms of movie watching, but I'm going to try and make the numbers work. So far I've been successful, but on the other hand, we're still in January. So I'll keep you posted how it's going.
Paul, this is an episode where we're going to be recapping and kind of adding our responses about the obesity episode. I'm a little worried about your screen time and what it might do to the waistline.
It's mostly sedentary time at this point.
You should put a treadmill in front of the TV.
Okay, so I don't...
Okay, thanks. Ignore that one. Fine.
That's not a bad idea, actually.
Okay, thanks. I feel better.
I just, when you started talking, I assumed it was going to be nonsensical, and I tuned out.
I actually... put a treadmill in front of a Netflix TV for my kids, and they're using it.
Wow.
I know.
That's kind of...
Yeah. Once they stop using the treadmill, it turns off.
This is not a food pun. The book is called Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi, and it's basically a book about networking, which is, I guess, kind of a term that has negative connotations, but in this sense, it talks about how you can network in a strategic way, add value for other people, build a network of resources and friends. And I think it's really an important skill for medicine. And I guess just for regardless of what career field you're in, this is the kind of thing the world works by. If people like you and if you know people, things are going to go more smoothly. So this book really just has a lot of practical knowledge that you can apply And it definitely talks about how to approach conferences and how to network while you're at conferences, which in medicine, we have lots of conferences. So I would highly recommend it. Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi. And of course, we'll put all this in the show notes as usual.
Yeah. So one of my colleagues just gave me a book that's on my reading list. I just wanted to mention it only because Eat is in the title. I haven't read it yet. I have no clue what it's about. So I guess you'll find out. It's called Leaders Eat Last.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. No clue what it's about, but I'll find out soon. Anyways, that's not my pick of the week. My pick of the week is Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix. So this was originally a movie that starred Jim Carrey. I was not a fan of the movie, but the series, it follows the book series very, very faithfully. There's 8 episodes that were released on the 14th of January. I binge watched all of them. It's pretty cool. I like it. And my kids laughed nonstop. So there was that.
So 3 recommendations.
And they're all sedentary.
Exactly. Yeah,
super solid medicine. Really could be practice changing for you.
Definitely appropriate for the obesity episode recap.
So we talked to Dr. Timothy Garvey, who we called Tim for the episode, the writer of the 2016 ACE Obesity Guidelines. And we just wanted to highlight some of the points that he talked about and fill in some of the gaps where we didn't have time to get into fully in depth. And the first thing that I wanted to talk about, and I have to admit my ignorance here, much like other areas I've been ignorant on the show, was the whole obesity is a disease movement. I kind of missed the boat on that you were... I understand that obesity is a disease, but kind of the mindset of thinking of this as a chronic disease and talking it to patients about this as a chronic disease, I think is a really nice tool that I got out of that. When you explain it to them, it's like you have obesity. It's like you have diabetes. For your diabetes, you might need to take medication for the rest of your life. If you make a lot of lifestyle changes, maybe we can get you off those medications. But obesity is a chronic disease. It's always going to be there. We're going to have to struggle to treat this. And that was just something that I had never really conceptualized it that way. We did spend a little bit of time talking about it with Dr. Garvey. He was actually featured in an article, which I read a couple days later. I kind of got sent it on Twitter, and he was talking about this a little bit more in depth. Obesity is a multifactorial chronic disease. It has genetic and social factors, as well as comorbidity issues that promote more weight gain. So it really is an uphill battle. And one of the big things that's talked about in the New England Journal review article on obesity, which came out, I believe it was yesterday, online.
Yeah.
They go into talking about the mechanisms of obesity, and we'll link to that in the show notes. And I would highly encourage all of you to read that or at least skim it and look at the figures, because they do shed a lot of light on this.
Yeah, I think I regret not being able to be a direct part of that episode, because I thought you guys did a fantastic job. And I think empowering is the right word, especially, you know, when you approach obesity not as a personal flaw, but as an incredibly complex disease with a lot of factors that are difficult to address. And that's pathophysiologically much more complex than we've initially laid it out to be. I think that takes a lot of sort of judgment and onus sort of off the patient, and just makes it sort of again back into the realm of a shared decision of something that you just need to work as a team to try to make better. So I think if you actually come from that mindset, it immediately takes some of the stigma away and makes it easier to actually approach sort of clinically and sort of less judgmentally.
So what Paul was just saying about the complicated pathophysiology that underlies this, there is this, the mechanisms for obesity, it's a mix of genetic factors, environmental factors, and then dysregulation of the energy balance. And this New England Journal article says that there's probably 40 to 70% of obesity is due to heritability.
Right.
But the rest of it is some of these environmental factors. The environmental factors can influence the expression of your genome. They're not necessarily going to change your DNA, but they will. Well, they won't change the DNA sequences, but they might change your epigenetics, right, and your transcription.
Yeah, we were talking about this off air before we started recording, But, you know, I think one of the best ways to understand this is understand the implications of sleep apnea. So if you have obstructive sleep apnea and at night your O2 sats are dropping down to the point where your body says, oh my goodness, I'm about to die, it's going to pump out a lot of norepi, epi, cortisol, and adrenocortical steroids. And those steroids are going to affect the transcription rates of certain genes. So when they talk about the epigenetics at the transcription level, they're talking about the effects of these corticosteroids on the transcription rates of certain proteins that are going to affect the metabolic status.
The big point of all these mechanisms is that the high relapse rates that happen in obesity, it's not necessarily the patient's fault, the patient falling off.
Right.
I think we've all seen patients in clinic that say they're eating correctly and they're active, but they're not gaining weight or they're not losing weight, they're staying the same. It's that there's something about their physiology, something about this set point that we talked about with Dr. Garvey that just kind of impairs that process. And that's why you have to think of obesity as a chronic disease. And it's really going to require a lot of different tools to treat it, whether it's medications, lifestyle changes, or even surgery.
Now, having said that, though, you know, that's not a carte blanche excuse to say, oh, well, you're gaining weight because of these epigenetic factors. We still have to look at their diet, their exercise, their sedentary lifestyle and say, we know it's a difficult disease to deal with, but we still need to make sure that we are readdressing these things that we know help to affect a significant and meaningful weight reduction.
The next part I wanted to just reiterate, the percent weight loss that someone can realistically expect to lose. If you're talking diet and lifestyle, that's only going to be about 5 to 10% of their weight. But the good news there is that things like blood pressure, A1C, some of the lipids, those can be affected even as low as 5% change in their weight. When you're looking at 10% weight loss, that's usually enough to prevent progression to diabetes. That might improve their sleep apnea symptoms. That's diet and lifestyle. If you add on medications, now you're going to start getting more than a 10% weight loss. And things in order to get like a 30% weight loss on average, that is only really seen with the surgeries, the gastric sleeve or the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. But if you do look at some of these figures from the New England Journal Review article, some patients, there is a small percentage of patients on the medications that would lose higher percentages in this range, in the 30% range.
Yeah. And it all kind of depends on what the stimulus is that's causing them to gain weight. You know, if someone is eating because they derive pleasure from eating, then using, you know, the naltrexone bupropion may be an appropriate medication to stop that pleasure center from receiving that excessive dopamine response.
The medications, the problem with medications and the reason why I haven't used them, and I talked about on the other show, is lack of familiarity.
Yeah.
I do want to start using them. And after talking with Dr. Garvey, I think it's important to start using them, especially in patients who are adhering to the lifestyle changes and start to see kind of a plateau in their progress or start to regain the weight. I think you really have to think about using these.
Yeah, one of the things that really highlights that is something that happened just recently when I was speaking with one of the resident physicians. There was a patient that we were seeing, a very nice lady whose BMI was in the 60 to 70 range. And she had gained a significant amount of weight since starting gabapentin, which is associated with weight gain, albeit a small percentage. And, I was talking with this resident about potential changes that we could do to help with weight loss. She was already trying some of these lifestyle changes and was not going anywhere. And so when I asked him about the medications, the only one that he was familiar with was Orlistat. Now, when I went through the medications with him and I talked about the topiramate-phentermine combination, he was like, oh, yes. I remember a mix-up question about that. But that's the only other medication, even with prompting, he was able to remember, which tells us that potentially there's an educational gap when it comes to weight loss medications. And I believe that some of that is related to the way that we view obesity in general. We look at it, unfortunately, as a lifestyle decision and not necessarily as a disease. And if we looked at it more of as a disease to be treated, then knowing these medications would be a little easier for our physicians who are used to treating diseases and not necessarily lifestyle issues, albeit maybe inappropriately.
And Paul, you practice in an area where basically, a lot of patients are low income, either uninsured or underinsured. Do you see patients being put on these? There's five medications approved for weight loss. Do you see patients being put on these? And are any of the general practitioners using them?
We have one general practitioner who's actually does a lot of research with weight loss and is fully comfort with most of them. And she actually tends to favor the topiramate phentermine combination. And then in terms of the endocrinologists, and the ones that I have the most comfort with are the GLP-1 agonists, actually. And those we can actually get covered by a lot of insurances. Oftentimes, you have the dual indication for at least impaired glucose tolerance at the very least, because most of these patients have metabolic syndrome. And so you have an indication right off the gate to use them. So you can, you know, if you have sort of the higher dose GLP-1 agonists, that's something where I feel like a lot of just general internists should probably have some level of comfort with.
Right.
And then you can actually promote weight loss while actually addressing another potential concern at the same time. In terms of the other, like the orlistat and the lorcaserin, it's that those are not ones that I have a whole lot of familiarity with. And I think probably I'm perpetuating my own ignorance, which is why the residents don't think of it. So it's not something I teach much about because I just don't have a whole lot of comfort with it and so forth and so on. So I think it's a missed opportunity that I'm glad to have the chance to improve upon.
I think it's also worth mentioning the SGLT2 inhibitors and the low dosage GLP-1 receptor agonist, just to understand what expected weight loss you could get with those medications. So even with the SGLT2 inhibitor, they found that at 52 weeks, the weight loss was about 3-5%. And the GLP-1 receptor agonist, the lower dosage, is about the same, around 3-5% weight loss. And this is not looking at the higher dosage liraglutide. So even with something like the exenatide, the weekly prolonged release, you can still get an effective weight loss. It may not be as effective as the higher dosage, but it's still there.
Right. Absolutely.
I would encourage people to at least look up the side effects. You can use a review article like the New England Journal one. It does tell you the starting doses. It tells you, in general, the common side effects and the contraindications. And I think you can sort of try your hand at these medications. Like Dr. Garvey was saying, they're relatively safe and well-tolerated as long as you pay attention to the contraindications and have some understanding of the side effects and the pathophysiology. And personally, I'm going to definitely start using these in my practice. It may take a little bit of working with the various insurance companies to try to figure out which ones you're able to get for patients. But I think that when you take the view that this is a chronic disease, like diabetes, like high blood pressure, medications are often going to be indicated. It's uncommon for a patient to be able to control these with just lifestyle.
Right. You know, something else that's worth mentioning that we didn't talk about is the comorbid depression that you oftentimes see with morbid obesity. Now, we don't oftentimes think about that, but oftentimes you may need to consider treating the depression, because the depression alone may be a significant barrier for weight reduction, just to start an exercise plan or consider a dietary change. One of my favorite medications to consider in someone who is overweight and depressed is actually bupropion, because it is associated, not across the board, but more with weight loss than with weight gain that you might see with SSRIs or with SNRIs. Having said that, some patients who take bupropion do experience weight gain, and you've got to be careful. And oftentimes those patients that experience weight gain are those who are eating not because they derive pleasure from it, but because it's maybe cultural or something that they're doing. I'm trying to think of the term. But it's more of just a habit, a habitual thing, instead of more something that they're doing to derive pleasure from.
Like a
compulsion. So if someone has a compulsion, it may not necessarily be as effective. However, bupropion can be helpful for some compulsions. But in general, it's more effective if they're eating because they derive pleasure from that. So that's someone who's depressed and they eat chocolate, for example.
Stuart, I wanted to ask you, you're our resident coding expert. What is a coding tip that you can share with the audience on obesity?
Well, aside from the fact that ICD-10 thinks that all obesity is from excessive calories, it's just understanding the cutoff between obesity and morbid obesity. Diagnosing and coding for morbid obesity appropriately is going to help increase your medical decision making on your E&M, and it could potentially be the difference between a 99214 and 99215. I would recommend that you code with BMI on top of that morbid obesity. the codes for that, you can certainly look those up at like the E&M University or ICD10data.com. But it's helpful to understand what these codes are. Add them to your favorites list, because oftentimes we're undercoding. We may be coding for the obesity, but not the morbid obesity. If you're going to code for morbid obesity with a BMI between 35 and 40, you also need to code for the comorbid conditions. So something like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, obstructive sleep apnea, any of the comorbid conditions that could be related to that obesity, you should code for that.
Okay, thank you. We'll definitely be coming back to you on these roundtable episodes to just try to get some coding tips. I know you've done a lot at CashLAC for improving the coding there, which apparently had a lot of room for improvement. Okay, I think the last part of this that I wanted to kind of get into is just going through some tips, tools, and tricks that we've used to treat obesity. Maybe things that have, definitely things that have been successful for us in clinic.
I actually want to jump to number two, where it says epic fail from Dr. Watto.
Epic fail. I'm trying to think what case I had in mind when I...
Which case didn't you have?
What case didn't I have?
Actually, I wouldn't mind talking about one of my failures.
Yeah, please.
And it's actually sort of a general failure. I think in terms, you know, we talk about the importance of diet and exercise, and I think it's easy to fall down just because we don't have the time or really the education to do a good job with it. But I think for a long time, until I was corrected, I was treating the diet component of treating obesity as just a simple math problem. You know, I think that's how we're often taught how to present it. Whereas if you take in fewer calories than what you need, you lose weight. And if you take in more than what you need, you gain weight. And so just eat less calories, please. And that's actually, it's such a small component of it. And I think that's such a oversimplistic way to present it and a sort of self-defeating way to present it with patients rather than sort of in terms of actually giving tips for eating more healthfully. I think that's a great example of sort of a bad way to go about it. And it's also something that's quite literally not true. Like if you actually follow that mathematical linear model, if a patient takes 100 calories less than what they did the year before, they would end up with like a negative weight by the end of their life, which is not actually possible. Because you know, the actual mathematical models are really dynamic and complicated. You can look them up online. But I guess the point being is if you oversimplify it again and make it almost as an accusatory, like if you would just simply eat less calories, you would lose weight. But that's just not the case. And in fact, weight gain actually raises your BMR, it raises your basic metabolic rate, and it actually takes more energy to have a higher body mass. And so it's not as straightforward as I'd originally made it out to be. And I think that was a large mistake in terms of my counseling fairly early on in my practice.
And that kind of highlights the one of the issues that we talked to Dr. Garvey about, Tim, was utilizing your multidisciplinary team. So understanding how your dietitian can help you to counsel with the appropriate dietary sources instead of just talking about calorie reduction, but understanding what high quality versus low quality calorie sources are.
Something that's out there, I think a lot of people think that low carb is the only way to lose weight right now. I think that's sort of out there. And there hasn't really been a diet, to my knowledge, that has shown that there has been no macronutrient concentration that or composition to a diet. When you're talking about macronutrients, you're talking about carbohydrates, fat, and protein. There's no ratio of those that's necessarily been proven better than another for weight loss. But I do think you have to just focus on quality of the calories. I mean, if all they're eating is those 100 calorie packs of mini brownies, that's probably not going to, even if they're eating 2000 calories a day from that or 1500 calories a day from that, it's probably not as good as if they were getting most of that from lean meats and fruits and vegetables. So you, all that has to come into play. And that kind of leads me to Paul, in the inner city where you're practicing, how do you get around some of these dietary and lifestyle changes? For I'm sure a lot of our listeners are in the same boat where they're practicing, where their patients have limited resources.
Well, yeah, I think broadly the important thing is to sort of know what resources that you have. You know, it's even in my own clinic, we don't have a dietitian, which sort of makes it very challenging. So there's a couple of things you can do. You know, if you can work within your health system, but I will sometimes refer patients to bariatric surgery because that is a department that at least has a dietitian and a nutritionist and has counseling. And even if, you know, the patient doesn't actually have a serious intent to go through the bariatric surgery, they at least have those resources and the chance for education at that level. And, you know, there we have, like, as I say, our own weight loss internist that I'll sometimes shuffle people off to. Sometimes I will use an endocrinology referral so that they can devote their time to education. I will take, you know, a little bit of impaired glucose tolerance and use that as a way to use that specialist resources since I don't actually have my own. So having said that, some insurances, you know, the subspecialist copay is unbearably high. And so you're stuck with other stuff. So we have, you know, local grocery stores that actually do diet and education classes. There's a lot of local farmers markets and food initiatives. There's one of the social services groups in the city in which I work actually has outpatient nutrition. You just have to know that it exists in order to get the patient there. So it's, some of it involves a little bit of self-education and knowing how to use the resources that you have in your around you. You know, there's a lot of great local initiatives near me. It used to be a food desert. It isn't anymore, but there's a really interesting study that showed, you know, a lot of the economy and a lot of the groceries are actually bought at these corner stores. And there's one study that showed kids on average stop there about twice a day. And for a dollar, they can purchase 1,500 calories worth of food. And it's staggering. And so if they're stopping there twice a day, spending $2, that's a 3,000 calorie diet. So do the math and figure out what's happening and why we're in the middle of an epidemic. And so there have been these local initiatives to actually educate these corner stores to sell healthier foods and actually sort of counsel against sort of these very high calorically dense, low nutritive value foods. So it's just a matter of, again, knowing what's around you and sort of leveraging that to your best effect. Mm.
And another thing, kind of just leveraging resources, if you don't have nutrition for face-to-face counseling, there is some evidence that counseling over the telephone can be almost as effective as face-to-face counseling. Online courses without any face-to-face person don't seem to be as effective as by phone or face-to-face, probably because there's less accountability.
There are actually ways to capture that as an E&M, as a physician. So if you're doing the counseling over the telephone, you can actually capture that productivity as well. There are ways to do that. We can talk about that in the future.
Okay. Guys, any final words or closing remarks about obesity? I mean, I'm sure we could talk about this forever, but these are meant to be shorter episodes, just where we get to kind of jump on our soapbox if we have one, or just add some hopefully valuable just tips and tricks that we didn't have time to bring up in the full length episode.
One of the things from my standpoint that I want other physicians to understand is that it's very important to assess for the barriers to weight loss. What are those barriers? And getting rid of those barriers as much as possible, involving other family members, involving someone who's going to hold them accountable, and understanding that you're going to be following up with these individuals on a very frequent basis in order to affect a meaningful and sustained weight loss. Effective counseling takes time. Motivational interviewing takes time. But if you invest that time, you will no longer look at that patient as a patient, and you'll look at them as a friend. And understanding that if you look at them as a friend, you're able to establish a rapport and a relationship with that patient that helps them to understand that you're there with them, that you're going to be there with them, and you're going to help them to attain the goals that they have and not just the goals that you have for them.
And the high intensity behavioral changes, those are 14 visits over a 6-month period. It's hard to get patients to commit to those and to get into them.
But if they see that you're invested, they'll do it. In fact, the only time I've ever been successful for weight loss without going through surgery is to make sure that I'm following up with that patient literally every other week. And I've had patients sign up for local gyms, lose between 50 and 100 pounds because they see that I'm interested. I'm calling them at home and saying, hey, did you go to the gym last couple weeks? No, I didn't. But I see that you're calling me. I see that you're concerned about me, and I'm going to do it for you, doctor.
Paul, you got any final words?
No. I will pay Stuart the rare compliment. I think that was beautifully said. That was the exact point I was going to make, is if we're going to treat this like a chronic disease, by God, we should treat it like a chronic disease and actually keep close follow-up, stay on top of it, and actually prove that we're invested in seeing this get better as well, just as much as we would glycemic control or blood pressure control. So I think that was really nicely said and a great point.
Well, thank you for that compliment, Dr. Crap.
Williams?
Yes.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. You can find show notes along with links to any articles, books, websites, or apps mentioned on the show at thecurbsiders.com/podcast. We're committed to providing you with high value, practice changing knowledge. So to do that, we need your input. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, or send us an email to thecurbsiders@gmail.com. You can recommend a future topic for the show or tell us what you love or hate about the show. Finally, Please follow us on our page on Facebook or on Twitter at The Curbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Watto.
And I'm Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham. And good night.
And I remain Paul Williams. Good night.
Oh, hi, Paul.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.